Good evening and welcome to Town Square. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. As we tell you each week, our conversations include you. And if you'd like to join us, the phone lines are open. 941-3689 is the number, 941-3689. And from the neighbor islands or anywhere else, if you're listening to the live stream, you can get to us at 877-941-3689. This week, many bills focused on affordable housing and public housing, and they continued to move forward. The Homeless Bill of Rights, well, it had been offered up for a second session and died again. As state and the city of Honolulu policies, or as the state and the city of Honolulu try to deal with policies that will impact the homeless, and as they debate them or see that some of them are already into effect, there are still agencies trying to help the people that they can. Tonight, we're going to look at homelessness through the eyes of some of the social workers who have spent a lot of time on the front lines of homelessness out there on the streets. And if that also describes you, well, we want to hear from you. Again, our number is 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Joining us this evening are Bill Hummel. He is a Hawaii Pacific University instructor of social work. He has extensive experience in services provided to people who are homeless and was the operations director of IHS for several years in the 1990s. He's since been involved with groups including River of Life Mission in Chinatown and Lighthouse Outreach Center in Waipahu to help the homeless. He also connects future social workers to local organizations to see firsthand what the vocation is really all about. Joining us tonight, too, is Heather Lusk, the executive director of the CHOW Project, Hawaii's statewide syringe exchange and harm reduction agency, and she's also the founder of HepFree Hawaii. She's over 20 years of experience working in the areas of HIV, STD, viral hepatitis, sexual health, and harm reduction. She's the secretary for Partners in Care, Oahu's Homeless Service Provider Coalition. And she's also secretary for the National Viral Hepatitis Roundtable, the nation's largest viral hepatitis advocacy organization. And she says almost two-thirds of the CHOW Project's participants identify themselves as homeless or marginally housed. And joining us is someone who once would have been in that situation too, Jean Mooney. She was homeless for over a decade and was struggling with addiction. Now she's the housing specialist for the CHOW Project, where she's worked for the last 3 years. And most recently, she's been collaborating with IHS on their City and County of Honolulu Housing First grant as a Housing First outreach and case management specialist for downtown Honolulu. Welcome to all of you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Beth Ann.
Thank you.
Now, we've had so much conversation, and no doubt we'll continue to have so much conversation about policies and procedures and counts in time and all of that that we see from the outside. But every day you all deal with this from the inside. When we talk about housing first and rapid rehousing, has there been too much conflating of those two things and making them so almost exchangeable in the way we talk about them, Bill?
Well, I liken it to the Abbott and Costello skit, who's on first. Unless you have a uniform definition of the terminology, you're not going to get communication. You're going to get miscommunication. And sometimes housing first is used to describe rapid rehousing, and sometimes rapid rehousing is not defined as the larger set of which there are subsets. And I think that adds to confusion. The conversation we had just before we went on, I was guilty of that myself, talking about housing first when I really was referring to rapid rehousing. My issues are pretty much with rapid rehousing. I think it's misdirected and is.
But before we get to sort of how you feel about some of that, because we're going to talk, we have a whole hour to talk, but to really get to this issue of do we misname one program when we mean the other? Maybe let's just be really clear about what one is and what the other is.
Well, my perception of it is that rapid rehousing is the larger set and housing first is a subset of that approach.
Well, and actually this Heather? Week, Beth Ann, the Partners in Care Oahu Homeless Service Collaborative actually voted on a set of policies, and one of them was definitions of housing first, rapid rehousing, temporary housing. So we are starting to have a common definition, at least on the service provider level, and I think Bill really named it that we need to help translate that into the community. You know, we see housing first as the folks that are the most vulnerable. And to put a number on it, we have an assessment tool that gives folks a number based on their vulnerability on different aspects. If they get a 10 or to 20, they qualify for housing first. And if they get a 5 to 9, it's rapid rehousing. And what that means is that the folks that qualify for permanent supportive housing, what we use housing first for, is really the ones that have many more needs, are very vulnerable, and really need to be housed potentially to stabilize them before we can kind of wrap around the services. Whereas those that may have rapid rehousing have some more stability, hopefully have some more income, because it's a much more short-term subsidy that they would qualify for, and then would have to really take on the entirety of their rent after a year or so.
Because the issue that most people seem to glom onto is, well, you can't really help somebody unless you get him into housing and you get him off the street. Right. Then you can wrap everything else around them. And so everything else seems to fall into that basket. And what you and Bill are clearly saying is that there are different baskets.
Very much so. And different needs of different populations. And it's not a one-size-fits-all approach, as Bill was saying earlier.
Have we tried to approach it as if it is, despite the fact that we've talked about different populations, that we have families, that we have singles, that we have people who have mental illness, that we have people who are addicted?
You know, I do believe that that's been a challenge. For example, it took a long time to have an assessment tool that was family-oriented, that was not from singles. So I think you're right. We're still kind of teasing out those issues. But supposedly this assessment tool, which is now going to be a coordinated entry system for everybody that's homeless that wants to get some support, the evidence says that it does help tease out those differences if we truly can get accurate information to then match them up with the type of services they need.
Jean, since you're out there doing this a lot, how difficult is it to get really accurate information? I mean, how well do you know these people, and are they in fact telling you the truth?
Well, you know, that's one of the issues, because the VICE-BDAT, which is the standardized measurement tool, is self-report. So say, even though I know somebody who's extremely medically vulnerable and they're addicted and they have mental illness, but they're answering all the questions, oh, no, I'm fine. You know, I have to write down what they say. I can make a notation of what I know, but the score is based on their self-report. So it's hard sometimes.
Does that sort of game the system a little bit?
Well, I think there's a number of different factors that feed into that being a problem. One may be gaming the system. Another may be just that the individual is embarrassed, or the individual, you know, we talk about this with the students in the social work program all the time. What is it that would cause someone to give you misinformation? Well, it may be they don't like you. It may be they like you, and they don't want you to think ill of them. Mm. It may be they're embarrassed. It may be they're not even aware. So there's a whole host of things that that really take some skill to cull out. And the VICE-BDAT doesn't really serve that purpose. It's
a
first screening.
I think you should define what the VICE-BDAT is.
The intake mechanism that was just mentioned for housing first to determine the degree of severity of need, and it's a it generates a score, and if the score is high enough, that dictates that you're eligible for the services that Housing First makes available. So answers mean a lot. You know, I think that's a real issue. And there is some manipulation on some clients' parts, but that's not the major piece. I think the bigger piece that needs to be looked at is it's misinformation, whatever drives it. And that's a problem.
When you are having to encounter what you encounter on the street, whatever it may be, because from day to day it may be very different, but yet there are certain similarities. Now that we're actually able to look at some of those subsets and subsets of subsets and really start to say, no, we're talking about so many variables with real people here in real situations. You mentioned, Bill, you know, the variables of why someone might not tell you the truth, and not always tending to go to the very negative, oh, they're gaming the system, or there's something, you know, afoot here that we look at and shake our heads. as you see these little pieces happening, how much do you think is actually percolating back up the chain to people who are looking at making policy and at really understanding what these issues are so that they can make an informed policy that will actually address the issues that you're trying to fix?
I think it's beginning to happen, Bethann. And what I mean by that is Focused, who takes these vulnerability index, I think it's called services prioritization and data assessment tools, what VISPADAT stands for. They are starting to be able to tease out some of these pieces of how many folks are medically vulnerable, how many have addiction, how many have mental health, how many families are there. So hopefully once, since everybody's going to have to use this tool to get into this coordinated entry system, we folks like Focus and others will be able to look at this data and be able to start to have a profile of many different communities and folks that are affected by homelessness.
But that's going to take a while to
it
get some of that data.
It is going to take a while, yes.
And so we can't assume that that's, you know, not going to be part of this whole process as you're trying to address the needs of people right now. I mean, that's the so the longevity good part of it, that you're going to bring out some really great data.
We're not
meanwhile,
there yet.
You're going to have to be able to address some of these issues. If you're just joining us tonight, we're talking about homelessness and what it looks like for someone who is out there every day dealing with the homeless population, trying to help. We have three social workers around the table with us, and if you are in that pool of folk too, we want to hear from you. Or if you've been helped by someone, 941-3689 is our number, or 877-941-3689. We're really talking about tonight, what is it that all these people know that the rest of us should know as we talk about the debate over what to do to help the homeless, as we talk about policies and procedures and the best way of being able to deal with homelessness in our neighborhoods. 941-3689, 877-941-3689, because we're talking about real people here and the real people that the people around this table see each and every day. 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Let's myth bust a little bit here just before we get into some other parts of the conversation. What else is there about what you see on a daily basis that you think the rest of us really don't understand, even though we think we might, or there may be certain discussions around a part of the issue, but not necessarily connecting how those issues in sort of the micro sense fit into a larger picture?
You know, one really concrete example, Bethann, is the challenges of our people that are homeless getting document ready for housing. So, for example, before I got into this work, I didn't understand how challenging it was for someone that's homeless to keep documents, especially because they're stolen or they're confiscated by because of the sit-lie ban or other reasons. And to help them get a picture ID, and Jean can probably speak even more to this, can sometimes take weeks because of they don't have a birth certificate. You need a picture ID to get your birth certificate, but then you need a birth certificate to get your ID. So all of the hoops that you have to jump through just to be what we call housing or document ready is much more vast than I ever understood before we got into this work.
And much more complicated for someone who's Micronesian.
Exactly. Good point.
It takes that much longer. It costs tremendously more. It happens as much with Micronesian folks as non-Micronesians. It's just a bigger problem for them.
Jane?
Yeah, and I definitely think that is one of the biggest barriers to helping people, you know, get off of the streets is their identities. You know.
How hard was that for you? I know we're thinking back a ways now because it's been a while since you've been homeless.
Yeah, we're thinking back a ways. You know, I was fortunate that a family member had my birth certificate, a family member had my Social Security card. So it wasn't that difficult for me. But what I'm finding for, you know, our folks on the streets is, you know, they get robbed every other night. You know, I mean, people cut other people's pockets out of their pants when they're sleeping to get to whatever's in the pocket. It's really hard out there. You know, they lose things in the sweeps when the city and county comes and just brings a bulldozer and takes everything. And then if they want to get their things back, well, they've got to pay some money.
Which they don't have in many
cases. Of course not. You know, so it's just a really huge barrier. It's a catch-22. You need one document to get the other, but you can't get the other unless you have this one, you know.
Yeah, the analogy I use at the shelter with our students who do the case management is our job is to get our guests ready to move on to the next step, which would be transitional housing. The analogy I use is a bus. If you're sitting at a bus stop and the bus comes and you have bus fare, you get on the bus and you go where you need to go. If you're sitting at a bus stop and you don't have bus fare, the bus leaves and you're still at the bus stop. And so the folks who come into emergency shelters have needs, documentation, one of the larger ones. But there are many, many others that take a long time as well. But if they doesn't happen often enough, but when the time comes that there is a resource, there is an opportunity, an opening in a transitional shelter, if they don't have the documents, if they don't have the savings, if they don't have the money, somebody else gets that spot and they're still in the emergency shelter. So it's very difficult.
Tonight we're talking about homelessness, the nuances, the shades of it that the rest of us may not understand because we're not dealing with people who are homeless every single day. But the people around the table tonight are. We have Bill Hummel here and Jean Mooney and Heather Lusk. All of them are dealing with this every single day, trying to help people better their lives. In the case of Bill Hummel, he's also teaching students to do that at HPU. And if you're involved in some way, we want to hear from you, too. Really, what is the ground-up view of homelessness that we just don't seem to talk enough about, according to my panel tonight? Our number is 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Going now to Dave calling us from Waipahu. Aloha, Dave. Welcome to Town Square.
Hi. You know, it really bothers me. I reported this poor woman that was on Hotel Street by bus stop, and she pretty much has made that her home. And she reeks of urine like no one's business. You can smell it from 50 feet away. People avoid her like a plague. And I called IHS. I said, hey, you guys got to help this woman. And they were giving me a bunch of, they said, oh, well, we can't do anything because she refuses to get some help and all that kind of stuff. And I said, listen, you're a danger. She's a danger to herself and to others. Public health hazard, if nothing else. And did they pass a law where, I mean, definitely she was mentally ill, very mentally ill. She was yelling and screaming and everything else. And matter of fact, you'll probably find her there tonight, the poor thing. And so I called back to IHS. Oh, yeah, we had her for about 5 days, and then she just walked out on us. And the thing is, I would think, they said, well, the psychiatrist can, she just acts normal when she's in that psychiatrist. And I said, wait a minute. You're saying that someone that reeks of urine, urine smell, they're not psychotic? And anyway, if you guys, folks, can comment of,
What happens if you have
this system that allows this to happen?
All right. Bill Hummel wants to give you an answer, Dave, so sit tight for a second. When you have somebody like Dave is just describing, and there have been others like that, too, over the last couple of years. It's not just this particular woman. But what do you do when you have somebody like that?
This is a real difficult issue. Myself being a liberal Democrat, it's particularly difficult to look at and address, because common sense says that this woman needs help. But constitutional law says that you can't make her receive the help unless she's a danger to herself and others. Common sense would say sitting in a pool of urine on Hotel Street every day of your life makes it a danger to yourself. My understanding in this case, IHS went to court with others to try and get a determination that this woman should be forced to receive psychiatric help, and lost. The judge ruled against them. So they did the right thing here, but there are limitations. And sometimes laws are passed and interpreted with the best of intentions and create a whole lot of difficulties. And I think this is an example of that.
Does it also point out, though, that when we see somebody like this and we automatically, sort of jump, well, why isn't anybody helping? How come they aren't doing something? That we really have to stop and maybe do a little digging to find out whether or not somebody has tried to help or not, as in the case of this woman and another woman like her.
Yeah, it kind of moves the issue from the micro piece of the woman on the street to the macro piece of legislation and appeals. And that takes that much longer. It's much more frustrating, but that's the only way to go.
And my understanding is there is a bill this session that IHS is purporting that would make it potentially easier for them to go into court and get basically mandate them to be on psychiatric meds to balance that. Because you're right, it's that self-determination of that person versus some of the issues that bill brought up.
We had a large conversation as the beginnings of that bill was happening last year. Is this in fact going to take someone's civil rights away? And there was a lot of very rich conversation about, well, you know, how do you balance that? Which is exactly what, you know, Bill, you're talking about, mm-hmm. looking at what do you do for someone who's sitting there in, you know, a pile of, you know, whatever and reeking of whatever and clearly not able to act as any other person would be saying, well, this is not what you do. And to hear that someone can't be helped like that seems to go so against the grain of, as you say, common sense. But how do you balance that? And aren't we always going to be in a situation where, by virtue of the system, it's not going to be able to help everybody?
I think you named it, Beth Ann. I think that that's that challenge, and that's why it's going to be interesting to see if this bill is implemented, what that looks like. And I would like to see from Jean, though, because I know some of the folks that you work with may not be to this extreme, but mm-hmm. how do you balance that self-determination of maybe not wanting help or not wanting the kind of help that's offered with trying to support them in services, both for them but also for the community around them?
Right. Well, I definitely try to see what they think they need help with and then take it from there. You know, instead of like me coming and forcing this rules and this and this and that on someone else, you know, I'm going to let it be kind of client led. And that creates an environment of trust where then I can start, you know, putting in the pieces of, well, why don't we go, you know, take a shower today, you know, and I will literally physically take somebody.
So you're looking for a foot in the door, any way you can get it to
yes.
be able to build some trust, even if you can't address what you would like to at that moment. You're looking for any way in, if they'll let you, and that's a big if.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
Bill
I think
Hummel.
That's she's described the engagement process, you know, and that's what we teach in social work, is social services are delivered successfully through the cultivation of a relationship. And thinking, as a lot of folks might, that what you need to do is go down there and get her off the street. Doesn't work. What works is the long-term cultivation of a relationship, as Jean so aptly put it, addressing things on a value system that's of value to her, not something that's of value to us. So it's trying to find a mix of that. And very difficult and takes time. Takes a lot of time and a lot of effort.
And something that the rest of us don't necessarily understand in terms of the timeline that you deal with.
Absolutely. The quick fix doesn't work. And whether that's on a micro level like this or a macro level like legislation, the quick fix doesn't work. I think just to leapfrog a little bit, that's part of my concern about some of the approaches to solving problems. We tend to move towards the quick fix. And also we tend to move towards the cheap fix. You know, I say all the time, if a water main breaks, the powers that be in government don't sit down and say, how can we fix this and not spend money? They say we need to fix it. In this situation, we've gone 20 years without addressing this problem substantively, with the exception of Governor Lingle's move towards developing the shelters. But other than that, there really hasn't been a substantive, comprehensive approach to solving this problem of homelessness.
All right, we're going to move over to some of our callers now. We have Daniel calling us from Kauai. Aloha. Dan, thanks for your patience.
Yeah, no problem. So I'd like to start off by saying that I was homeless when I was in high school, parts of high school. And I was homeless sometime afterwards. And I eventually got into college, and I spent some time being homeless there as well to kind of get myself through college. And, you know, there's, I would say, you know, at the very beginning of the conversation, we started talking about people gaming the system. And I think that's kind of a symptom of the overall problem we have nationally, where, you know, essentially the government from the ground up, from local to national levels, work at the behest of capital. And we slipped into a form of capitalist feudalism, and we have serfs. And these serfs are working in poor people, and a lot of them are homeless. And what we don't ask is, what happens when the bankers game the system? What happens when the corporations game the system and put money offshore and avoid paying taxes? With this money that they are gaming the system with, we could easily house the poor. We could easily house the homeless. We could provide them with medical care. And, you know, it's just very strange to me that we could easily find money to send to, you know, Israel for bombs or, you know, to some other country for war, but we can't help our own people. And we need to ask ourselves where we are as a country when we can't take care of the poorest of the poor unless we're concerned about them, quote unquote, gaming the system.
All right, Daniel, our panel wants to answer you. Thank you very much for your thought-provoking question. What do you say to him when he says, why can't we take care of the poor support and look at our own people first?
A large part of me agrees with him 100%. I think that, you know, a lot has been made of the businesses in Waikiki that have donated money to address the homeless issue in Waikiki. I'm not as big a fan of that because I think it's embarrassing the little bit of money that's been forthcoming. There's so many businesses whose major gross generators are in Hawaii, Costco. Businesses in Waikiki, Amez, their stores break records in terms of amount of money made. And nothing was done about the problem till it was on their doorstep. And it's on their doorstep, and the amount of money that's been donated thus far is not even a drop in the bucket. So there should be some embarrassment about what's not being done. So along those lines, I agree with the caller. I think not enough is being done, and I think part of the problem is homeless people don't vote. And so there isn't a consequence for some of our legislators. I think the state legislature bears a tremendous amount of responsibility for the mess we're in. Over $220 million over 10 years that was allocated for affordable housing that was used to balance the budget. Well, when you do that for 10 years, you create the problem that we've got now. And that doesn't even touch on the conversation we had earlier about affordable housing not being the solution, but only part of the solution. But purely from a fiscal perspective, not enough is being done and not enough is coming from the private sector.
Heather?
Yeah, I have to say I also agree a lot with what the caller said. You know, where our values are, that we put profit over people, you know, is really troubling. And I think, you know, we work in Kaka'ako, right by where a lot of the encampments are. And I don't think it's a coincidence that the sweeps come through right before Hawaii 5-0 filmed over there. You know, it's the same thing that you're saying, that when it's in people's faces, when it's in the business faces in Waikiki, then they started to put some resources towards it. Mm-hmm. And so I think the more that we can humanize folks that are homeless, I really appreciated the caller. So many people have been homeless that we would never know it. And so more that we can humanize and show these, that these are people with lives, with families, that they may need to be reunified with, the more we're able to make that argument. And then honestly, the cost effectiveness argument's also happening. For example, a lot of our folks access the emergency room as primary care. Housing's been demonstrated to limit that. So I think we have to have a balance of humanizing folks, but also using our data to show that it is cost effective to house people in the housing first model.
How different was Daniel's story than what you hear now? I mean, he talked about being homeless during high school and obviously not wanting to delve into his private life too much, but homeless during high school, homeless during college, but he was going to college.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, as opposed to somebody who is not going to college, not trying to do something to in some way gain a skill set that would make him or her employable. Is he more of an anomaly than the
role? I don't think so. I think Bill said, as we were talking before, that there's so many faces of homelessness in so many different communities. I was doing a VI SPDAT, the assessment tool, a couple weeks ago at an event we were having, and I had he's in college and he's homeless, but he's choosing to use what little resources he has to put himself through school. And so again, I don't think that he's unusual. I had him. I had somebody else that had just moved here. I had someone who had been for 10 years homeless. I had people that were struggling with mental illness, but those that were not. It was a wide cross-section of folks in Hawaii.
And that goes back to the point that we can't just cover everybody with this blanket of homelessness and think that we know that it's this population or that population. Even when we start to sort them into things like, well, people who may be down on their luck, or people who may have mental illness, or people who may be addicted, or people who may simply have gotten a raw deal and suddenly find themselves homeless. If you're living with somebody and then the relationship breaks up, we've had a homeless teacher who we've talked to. I mean, all kinds of people to say that maybe there are a lot more homeless people than the rest of us ever even realize. Tonight we're talking about what does homelessness look like from the ground up. If you've got a story to share with us, we want to hear it. If you also help in this endeavor, we want to hear from you too. If you're a social worker, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Going to another Dan. Dan calling us from Honolulu, is it?
That's right, Beth Ann. Thank you. I heard that discussion earlier about when property is impounded by the city, people have to pay a $200 fee to recover it. My understanding has always been that if the person trying to get the property back is indigent and certifies that she or he can't pay for it, that the city will waive that $200 fee. So people who are homeless can get their property back without having to pay the $200 fine.
Is it actually happening?
I don't know that for sure, but I do know that a process, as far as I know, a process does exist for people to get that waived. I think one of the bigger problems is that the property is generally taken to an impound lot in Halawa. And so for a lot of people to go from Waikiki or Kaka'ako to get up there on the bus, that presents a real challenge.
Right. Thank you so much for letting us know that. But for those of you around the table, from what Dan has just said, do you have any evidence that some of the folks who you know who've had their goods impounded, which includes a lot of their documentation, they've actually been able to say, you know, I need a waiver and I need it back?
Yes, I'd heard about that policy as well. In practice, I'm not hearing of that being effective, again, partially because of the distance area. I hear it's several miles from the closest bus stop, not to mention you often can't bring a lot of the materials onto the bus that would be impounded there. But again, Jean's being out there on the streets, what are you hearing?
Yeah, well, I'm hearing that people are not going to get their stuff back because
there are barriers?
The barriers. Maybe they don't have a bus pass because, oh, it got taken. So they can't get on the bus to go get it. You know what I mean? They don't have someone to drive them there. They don't have a lot of things. And, you know, I just, it should be a law that, you know, the documents need to be given back to people, at least. Because, you know, we've got the public screaming, you know, do something about this homelessness. Yet our laws and our procedures are the complete opposite of what we're trying to do.
Well, you know, I found myself on both sides of the issue with the sweeps. I don't think that it is a good idea for people to live in tents on the street. But I think that to support the concept of the sweeps, you have to have alternatives available, and we don't have alternatives available. So, you know, one of the things we teach in social work is that you should view things contextually. In the context of our present situation, let's look at it and be honest. If folks were not living on the streets in Waikiki, we wouldn't be talking about this now. There wouldn't be the attention that was generated to it. So even though I have difficulty with it, I can understand where it comes from, and I can see it as the result of what's really going on. I think the example of getting documents back, if this was a business issue, if there was competition, there would be a movement to be user-friendly. It's not business. It's not in the marketplace. There isn't an incentive to be user-friendly, and homeless individuals suffer as a result.
And perhaps have to depend on the goodwill of someone who'd say, I'll take you down there, or a service that might come up through some organization or agency. If you're just joining us tonight, we're talking about homelessness, but a different take than we've been talking about it for many conversations past. Tonight, we're really looking at it from the ground up. What does it mean to be homeless? What does it mean to have someone who is approaching a homeless person and trying to help? We've got a table full of social workers, and if that also includes you, we want to hear from you. 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Policies, procedures, all of that we hear about, the bills moving through the ledge, all of it may be well-intended and may have some consequence, but does it really address in a sort of integrated way what these folks see on a daily basis? That's what we're talking about tonight. And our number is 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Going to Scott, calling us from Honolulu. Aloha, Scott. Thanks
Hi.
For your patience.
I'm so glad to be talking to everybody today. And it's a great subject, wonderful subject. I'd like to tell you that every week, I and my organization feed the people down at Ala Moana Park.
Awesome.
What we're noticing more than used to be are people who are working, have one and two jobs, and are still homeless. And I think it's from what I see, these people need to have a place to live
that they can afford.
We're not building them. These people are working not just 8 hours a day. Some of them are working 16 hours a day, and they still can't make enough money to pay for even the smallest place. Certainly, this has to, something to do with their education and their background. But this has to happen. This has to come about somehow. There has to be a place for them to live.
Scott, thank you so much for your call. We're going to talk about that a little bit because you touched on this a little bit, Bill Hummel, in the beginning of our conversation when you were saying, you know, affordable for whom? Really, we're talking about, we say those words, affordable housing. We talk about public housing. Really, what level of income are we talking about? If it's somebody who's making, you know, $50,000, is it somebody who's making $70,000? Is it a family of four trying to get by on $32,000? Who are we talking about with these units? And does this sort of back end us into a conversation about micro units and the necessity for those, as the legislature seems to agree exists?
I think it does, but I think it's necessary to preface that by saying that what we really need is a much more pervasive plan for addressing homelessness. Otherwise, we get into narrow issues. This, as you brought up, the question of affordable housing, the term affordable housing, you qualify as an applicant for affordable housing if you make $50,000 to $60,000 a year, $65,000 a year. That's not going to help the folks in my shelter. Nobody in my shelter makes $19,000 a year. So even if housing was available under the definition of affordable housing, it doesn't solve the problem for a large percentage of the homeless. What it does do with other changes is create housing for folks who can move up. But we need a mechanism to help people move up. Hawaii Public Housing doesn't have that mechanism. People move in, they don't move out.
They stay because it's affordable.
Absolutely. And there isn't anywhere to go. I think in order for the folks who are in shelters and on the street now to have access to resources, housing resources, some folks have to have somewhere else to go. And so in that context, affordable housing is a contribution to the problem. But I don't think it's understood that way by most folks. It's not enough to build affordable housing. It's necessary. It's needed. It's overdue. But it isn't enough by any means. The micro units, the concept of micro units is you know, scoffed at by some. But I think that that's exactly what's needed, precisely because of what we were talking about earlier, which is if you look at the multiple drivers for homelessness, it creates multiple scenarios of need that are different. You know, there's a and the book Fixing Broken Windows divides the homeless into the have-nots, the can-nots, and the will-nots. And that's a good beginning. And we could probably spend the whole night talking about that. But there are subsets to each of those, and there are overlaps with each of those. It's much more complex than most folks would think it is.
Do you have something to add to that, Heather or Jean?
Well, just that behind documentation, the next thing that we talked about being a barrier is a lack of not just affordable housing, but also lack of landlords willing to rent to the populations that we're talking about.
Yeah, there's no like landlord pool. I think it's because of lack of education. People don't understand what Housing First is trying to do or what, you know, permanent supportive housing is trying to do.
Because before you go on for a second, the idea with Housing First is that you would have these units sprinkled around,
yes,
and in various neighborhoods, so there wouldn't be like, oh, look, there's the project.
Right.
But there would really be indistinguishable from anybody else's unit.
Right. And that's how the state is doing it with the scattered site approach. And personally, I'm thinking micro units. I might even want to move into one. You know what I mean? It's like we've got to do something because there's not one, like Bill said, blanket solution. It's going to be several different, you know, aspects that are going to take care of this problem.
It's a portfolio approach.
Absolutely.
Okay, well, we've got lots and lots of callers on the line. If you want to be next, call us sooner rather than later, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Going to Edward, calling us from Waikiki. Aloha, Edward. Thanks for the patience.
Yes, my name is Edward. I was homeless for about 10 years before I got Section 8 through the veterans. Even in here in Hawaii, veterans get breaks, you know, to go to the head of line for Section 8. But other than that, a lot of these homeless I talked to, they had a plane fare home. Give them a plane ticket to hot spots, you know, like Seattle, Washington. They make $15 an hour. They can live like a king. That's minimum wage. Now, you know, a lot of these people are educated. They can get $30 an hour, like in manufacturing.
Okay, Edward, some of that's conjecture, but I'm really curious about you and your experience. You were homeless. You're not homeless now. What made the difference?
Well, I got Section 8. Okay. I was homeless for about 10 years, and I finally, you know, I'd be sleeping out in Pittsburgh, you know, in the wintertime, nearly freezing. And well, I was alcoholic, you know, I haven't drank now in 33 years.
Congratulations.
That helped, I suppose. But getting Section 8, even today I get Section 8, and I live in an apartment in Waikiki. And the rent's like $1,700 for anyone else, and I only pay $4.
Well, we're glad that you're well housed and safe. And thanks very much about bringing about veterans, because that was a group that we didn't mention earlier. Thanks very much, Edward, for that.
One other thing. I think they should have forced commitment. Like in 99, I was saying, in 1999, they let all the patients out of the state hospitals. I was in Spokane, Washington, and there were all of a sudden thousands on the street. They let them all out. And I think since then, they just let them out. I think they should bring back forced commitment. We have state hospitals, that they can cure them. I mean, I see them all the time, and they're just miserable, and they stink. And I mean, it's like they're mumbling. I think we could help them if we brought back forced commitment.
All right, Edward. Thanks very much for the call. But that presents some problems too, because we don't really have a whole lot of space. I mean, we have overcrowding at the state hospital, and we've talked about that ad nauseum. We're not going to go there tonight, but that presents a whole bunch of issues too. But his part about, well, I'm a veteran, and that was my entry. That was why I was able to get some help. Do we really address enough veteran homelessness now? We've heard about it for so many years. Is it actually getting to a point where you are seeing a difference?
Honestly,
Heather?
Yes, we are. And you know, the goal was to have in Hawaii, part of this 25 cities that Honolulu is a part of, to have all the chronically homeless veterans in at least on Oahu housed by the end of this year. And they actually think that from the data, we're going to be able to do that. So that would, again, we had some, you know, concerns before that of the hidden homeless and those that might not be counted, but there has been a very marked attempt towards housing veterans, and at least according to the numbers I've seen, they do think it might be doable to at least have the ones that we've identified housed by the end of this year and aligned with that goal, which is actually a federal goal among those 25 cities. So,
all right. Does anybody else have anything to add? Otherwise, we're going to go on to Carlos.
I would just say that I think vouchers for housing are a tremendous resource. But there's a complexity there as well. Vouchers that are open-ended, which means, as this gentleman described, it seems, he gets that rent subsidy forever. There are budgetary concerns about that. If you take care of 100 people this year, you need to pay that amount of money plus whatever you're going to do next year. Now, the alternative to that is to give people a limited amount of time, and that's been used, especially with the rapid rehousing, 2 years to improve their income. Which sounds very good, but we all know economically that doesn't happen. I think it was Philadelphia had success with rapid rehousing because they targeted individuals who made enough money already but had other impediments. And so in 2 years they could address the other impediments, but they limited it to people who had enough money to pay their rent themselves but just couldn't get it started or couldn't maintain it. And it's that narrowly focused use of the approach that's been successful.
But with Edward, because he's a veteran, I mean, there are those who make the case that we owe something to veterans that is unique and special, and we should recognize that that is a different situation.
No question. No question. I was only bringing it up to point out that I think a lot of folks then would say, well, subsidies are the answer. And subsidies would be the answer if there was an open-ended resource in dollars.
Okay. We're going to move on because we've got lots of callers and just 15 minutes left before we have to say goodbye. We'll try to get everybody through as we can. So keep calling 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Going to Carl calling us from Honolulu. Aloha, Carl. Welcome to Town Square.
Hello. Here's Carl, and thank you for taking my call. I used to be homeless in Kindabaly about 10 years ago, and then, was able to work my way up. But my question is, are there any agencies or any volunteer groups that go out and actually advocate to the people that are living on the streets to apply for these services or help build that initial relationship to bring them in so that they receive
I think
you're,
we've got a whole table full of them right now, Carl. I mean, that's one of the reasons why we're having the conversation. Did you have something specific that
hoping? I mean, their caseload's kind of full, and you don't see a lot of social workers that are out on the streets. Mainly, I think they're dealing with people who are coming to them for services. But I do a lot of outreach with the people in the Kaka'ako area, in the Chinatown area, and a lot of them do not know about the services, and they're afraid to go seek those services. They might have problems with law enforcement or things like that. And so I think there needs to be, like a kind of grassroots push to get this information out to the people who need those resources.
All right, let's ask some of those people who are around our table and who are also out on the sidewalk. Jean.
Yes. I am out on the streets probably 30 out of my 40-hour week, 30 hours, like with people, taking them to appointments, helping them fill out forms, doing whatever I can, whatever they perceive to be their most important goal, I'm going to help them with.
But Carl's point is there may not be enough people like you doing that, and that people in, for example, Kaka'ako, where he says he's out doing outreach, don't understand that there are services available. Bill Hummel?
I rather doubt that that's accurate across the board. Hawaii utilizes an approach to, and has for years, approach to addressing homelessness called the continuum of care. Continuum of care means that the government contracts with agencies to begin by doing outreach to folks on the street. The goal is to get them into into emergency shelters. The goal of the emergency shelter is to get them into transitional shelters, and the goal of the transitional shelters is to get them into permanent housing. The problems we've run into is there isn't permanent housing, and the pipeline backs up. But there are outreach workers. There are outreach workers whose job it is to engage the folks on the street. I know for a fact that agencies have gone to Kaka'ako Park specifically to pass out information about what's available. So that it's not accurate. There may well be some people there who don't know. But it's not accurate to say that nobody there knows.
All right, Heather.
Just quickly, what's nice about this new focus on housing first is we're now having collaborative outreach meetings through this process. So we actually had a meeting specifically about Kaka'ako, whether it's IHS or Caravan through Waikiki Health, and Chow and Kalihi Palama. It's like, okay, we'll go there on this day together, or you'll go there this day. So we're actually now starting to have a coordinated island-wide outreach effort. We're now looking at the windward side. When do people go there? How can we make sure leeward's covered? So it's actually getting more coordinated through this coordinated entry system, which is really, I think, a good benefit from the process.
And good news for you, Carl, too. Going to Paul calling us from Maui. Aloha, Paul. Welcome to Town Square.
Aloha. I wanted to, first of all, congratulate you on such an excellent discussion. And I have two questions, both of which require, I would say, reasonably radical thinking. The first is rent control. Why can't we have rent control pegged to people's employment and to their incomes, so that you wouldn't ever become homeless because you became unemployed? And then the second question is, why don't we have some way to curb the landlords who are the pernicious landlords, the ones who are in business, for the residential properties, and take tremendous profits off the backs of people for places that are not worth, people getting their mortgages paid and all the rest of that stuff. I think we need to really look at the way in which we deal with private property. And I'll listen to you guys out on the air. Thank you so much.
Thanks very much, Paul. Okay, he brings up a couple of points because there's and I hear that it's very heartfelt. But then again, you still say, well, we have a free market. And if somebody has the ability to rent to somebody who may be able to be relatively trouble-free and they're going to help to get their mortgage paid, you know, there are a lot of people who say, well, that's a good situation. They're building their own independence and they're taking responsibility for themselves by doing whatever they have to, including to rent to somebody who they know is going to be able to make the rent. The other issue is, how could we possibly bring in rent control? We had a whole show about that not too long ago, last summer, if I'm remembering. And there were a lot of problems with bringing that into being now, ostensibly for the reason of the first situation we just talked about, people who are trying to get as much as they possibly can because it's expensive to live in Hawaii, and they're trying to balance their own needs. So whose needs get taken care of first? Where do you move in this issue? Bill Hummel.
Well, I think, you know, if we look at it historically, homelessness exploded after the 80s. It exploded after the 80s for a number of reasons. One had to do with something we touched on earlier, people talking about commitment, you know, the horror stories of the state hospitals. And so people were let out of the state hospitals, and the plan was for them to be housed locally. Well, they didn't think about not in my backyard, and that didn't really work. Reagan's policies on not funding HUD during his presidency contributed massively to a changing of the homeless population from singles to families. We live in a democratic society. It's a capitalist system, and there are some restraints on that to make it civil so people can live, less so, and we're moving in an opposite direction. So where what was just proposed would be a humanistic approach for us, politically, it's probably not going to happen.
All right. That seems to be the consensus that we hear much, and I'm watching all the heads around this table nod. Thanks for the call, Paul. Going now to Karen calling us from Oahu. Aloha, Karen. Welcome to Town Square.
Yes, I am so angry. I'm so angry. And never mind the veterans and the people who are addicted, but I teach children who are homeless. And I've only lived here for 5 months, but in the 5 months I've lived here, I've watched kids drenched in water because of rain, and they've told me, oh, we have a bus to collect them. I don't understand why you don't have foster care on these islands. I don't understand why you don't care about these
Okay,
children.
Karen, I'm going to stop you right there because I know that you've only been here for 5 months, and maybe that's not a long enough time to absorb what may really be out there and things happening, but we've got people around this table who can give you some short answers to that. Heather?
Yeah, well, I'll be honest. We work more with adults than children, so I'd actually like to see what Bill has to say since his shelter works also more with families.
Well, I'm not sure what she was asking. Why don't we have foster care? We have foster care. It's not an appropriate foster care issue. Homelessness is not a crime. So I think that she may be very well-intentioned but misguided and misinformed.
Yeah.
Jean?
I will second that. Thank you, Bill.
All right, then. We're going to move on and talk to Jim calling us from Diamond Head. Aloha, Jim. Thanks for your patience.
Aloha. Hello?
Hello. We're here. We can hear you.
Okay.
Go ahead.
I was calling because I think that one of the problems we have is people don't want to pay taxes anymore. Not only people, but corporations, real estate companies and all. And it's gotten to the point where they're reducing the tax base to the point where there's not enough taxes coming in for social services. Also, when they build these enormous high-rises, they're not getting, I think, the amount of capital that's going to be required to provide these services for the people that are going to move into those buildings and also for the other people who are unfortunate and don't have housing.
All right, Jim, we're having a really difficult time hearing you, so we're going to just take what you've said. And anybody want to answer, Jim?
Well, I think the what was posed was that we're not taking enough money in to provide this. I would venture to say we're not deciding to provide it. It's how you cut the pie. It would be great if the pie was bigger, but even if it's not bigger, how you cut it determines who gets what. And again, I come back to the unfortunate situation, which is homeless people don't vote. You don't see Social Security being violated or planned to be eliminated, with the exception of a rather foolish attempt by George Bush, but you don't see that happen because the elderly vote, And it would be political suicide for a senator or a member of the House of Representatives to vote against the existence of Social Security. The lobby arm of the senior citizens in America is very strong. We don't have that for people who need and use social services. In fact, the safety net is shrinking and has been shrinking, as I mentioned before, since the 80s. We're moving in the wrong direction.
Would there not be any way of being able to mobilize that? Because we've heard that argument a lot. These people are marginalized. They don't vote. They're just trying to keep their heads above water. But when you talk to them, do they have any sense that that's also part of the deal? It's also part of the package if they want to take it, that they can vote?
You know, I think there is a growing, not just about voting, but also just that they have to contribute to part of the solution. And I do believe that there is a, getting back to what we talked about before, that folks are just trying to game the system. That is not our experience. Our experience is more trying to help people understand their responsibility as being part of the solution. And part of that is trying to organize most. And so there have been some times that we've organized some of our participants to come and testify at the legislature, to speak from their heart, tell their story, because I think that's what changes minds, is we're really hearing these stories and, again, humanizing.
Right, but the linkage anybody. That everybody keeps making is, well, they don't vote. Right. The problem is they don't vote, so they're not looked as being a viable constituency, yeah. Not worth perhaps a lawmaker's time to go, except to have the look good and the feel good part of it, perhaps, but not necessarily because these people translate in direct response and right. support for a candidate. I'm going to take one more call going to Carla, calling us from the Big Island. Aloha, Carla. Welcome to Town Square.
Hi there. Well, I've got a question. My question is, when and how are we going to stop inviting the wealthy out-of-state and foreign people to stop hogging the property and inflating the prices?
Okay.
We don't have so much space on the islands.
Okay. All right, Carla. Thanks for the question.
Okay.
There are many people who have said, you know, look, we've got a lot of foreign investment happening. We have, you know, people who have luxury properties. We're watching a whole bunch of them being built again. But it all comes back down to, well, it's still a free country and you still have the ability to choose where you want to live. And I can't tell you, I'm sorry, you can't move to Hawaii. We've had population discussions where someone has always said, well, can't we limit the population? Can't we tell people they can't have a number of cars? How do you continue to counter some of those same ideas when you encounter them?
Well, I do know from my understanding, the mayor's one of the new initiatives is to put a longer term on the affordable housing requirements for new development and to kind of grandfather in folks. So that's one of the angles, again, is to really try to work with folks that are doing development and coming in to say, well, where's your responsibility as part of our community?
But at what level? Because made the point around this table tonight that we aren't seeing it being addressed to the people that you're really serving.
That's
We're
true.
Talking about people who are at a higher price point.
Right. That's true. I mean, I think that whole piece of, am I part of the solution? Is it, Bethann? I mean, whether it's a landlord deciding, do I take a chance on this person that's not going to be the safe person versus, you know, am I willing to accept lower rent because I want to help this family that isn't able to afford it? There's no easy answer, but I just keep hoping that if we all see this as a community-wide issue and keep looking at all the ways that each of us can contribute, even if it's small, and one of them is with this micro units, is do you have a space in your home that you could help rent out to somebody at a very low cost or a reasonable cost, that you're still getting what you need to pay your mortgage, but they're also helping out somebody else. And I think we're just keep trying to figure out ways that folks can contribute to the solution.
If there are rooms in your house or you have a condo that you might share with somebody,
right.
that not to discount somebody just because they happen to have the label of currently homeless
exactly.
on them. I want to thank all of you for being here with us tonight. Heather Lusk, thank you very much for being here. Gene Mooney, and to Bill Hummel, too. We'll have to pick up this conversation again. And to all of you who called, too, I'm sorry for those of you who we couldn't get through. Next time, call us a bit earlier, but glad to have talked to you and glad that you're interested. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. This is Town Square. We'll be back with you again next week, and I'll see you tomorrow morning for the conversation. In the meantime, have a good evening. Aloha.